outing. Mark's off today, so Nick's been thrown in at the deep end. I don't usually like leaving guys down there alone when they're new, but when I told him I'd be gone for an hour, he didn't mind at all.
Thanks for the feedback, Pete. I'm glad it's working out. I'll go and see if he needs a lift home later.
Okay. See you, Karen.
If Karen had been interested enough to look, she would have seen the second perplexed male face of the morning staring after her, but her mind was already with Nick in the body room. She turned right, and in front of her was a cold, apparently empty, white-painted hallway. There was no sign of human life, and Karen walked alone towards the area Pete had indicated, past the relatives' area, the sluices and the drying room, and towards the freezers. If that was where Nick was eating breakfast, then that was a good place to start. Karen came round the corner, and there he was, clearly visible through the glass panel in the middle of the double doors. Poised over a steel trolley, the angle of his tall body obscured all but the feet of the corpse below him, arms spread, and his right arm raised above the body. Karen's immediate reaction was pride. No one was instructing him, no one giving him tasks to do. Here was her subject, taking the initiative, and dealing with a difficult situation on his own. She shrank back behind the doors and watched, as his hand rose and fell, and she thought to herself that he must be washing the body. There was something in his hand, which Karen couldn't see clearly. Nick was intent on what he was doing, and she waited to see what he would do next. This was exactly what she needed to observe. Concentration on one task, to the total exclusion of all others, was one of the 10 characteristics she had already classified as being transformable into useful social skills, allowing these subjects to contribute and function in society. Karen suddenly made out what he was doing. He was brushing hair, the strands of blonde rising, held up by static, from his hand. Long, translucent, white blonde hair, suspended in the position Nick lifted it into, then relaxing and falling slowly back towards the head of the cadaver. Karen decided not to disturb him, but to log the visit and come back at lunchtime. But just as she was about to turn, she caught something out of the corner of her eye and looked back towards the body room. Nick was bending towards the body now. Karen thought he must have noticed something out of place, but he kept on bending until his face was close to hers, and then he smoothed her hair back from her forehead, and he kissed her. He kissed her on the forehead first, and then the cheek. The last thing Karen saw as she backed down the corridor was his hand pushing the sheet down from her body, and his mouth covering hers. Karen retraced her steps, heart pounding, walked straight into the lift, and hurried head down to her office. Shutting the door behind her, she scuttled to her desk. The question she had burning in her head was simple. What should she do? Karen thought back through the many experiences she had of children and adults on the spectrum. She knew that if children were already suffering from Asperger's, the way they were treated when young was incredibly important. Abuse of any sort, physical or sexual, was incredibly difficult for these children to process, and their adult behaviour became skewed as a result. It was true for anyone, but Asperger's sufferers didn't have the emotional tools to distinguish between good behaviour and bad. That was often cited as a reason why there was such a high proportion of Asperger's sufferers in the prison system. The original condition was exacerbated by trauma, and, as with any vulnerable group, autistic children were more likely to end up in care or in boarding schools and were at a higher risk of abuse. You had to love the human race. The weakest were always most likely to be attacked. Karen needed to find out whether Nick had gone through any childhood trauma that had made him more detached than was usual when you were at his level on the autistic spectrum. He seemed to have a pronounced detachment for his intelligence level. Karen compared him to Temple Grandin, someone who had achieved great things by using every coping strategy at her disposal. She had tried therapies and drugs and even a cattle press to subdue her anxiety. That was the gold standard for Asperger's achievement, whereas Nick did not seem, from what she had seen so far, to have had the benefit of much intervention at all. She would wait and watch, but interacting with a cadaver was not a good sign. Karen decided to ignore the voice in her head telling her that leaving him in the morgue was not a good plan. When 12:30 came round, Karen took a deep breath and headed back towards the lift. It was set at the back of a little-used corridor. Death was not something that sat well with the patients, which Karen had always found odd. Surely the possibility of death was all around us, and having it hidden and whisked away like a magic trick seemed like denying something fundamental. She stepped out into the corridor for the second time, and it was a different place entirely. Pete was standing chatting to an orderly outside the break room, coffees in hand, and Nick was walking towards them, eyes down.
"Hi, Nick."
Karen got no response, so went towards him. As she got closer, his agitation at her arrival was clear. His hands started flapping, and he half turned away.
"Don't worry. I just popped down to see if you were getting on okay. Do you want some lunch or a lift home? I can run you now and then come back to work."
The closer she got, the more agitated Nick became. "I get the bus from the corner, 20 minutes, because they can use the bus lane, and then I walk to my job. I don't need a lift, and I have work here this afternoon." With this, Nick picked up a sandwich and drink from the side and walked back towards the freezers.
"Nick, don't forget to clean up if you drop crumbs."
Pete was grinning as he said it, and Nick didn't turn, but his head was nodding, and his steps got a little faster.
"Jesus, he may not be very communicative, but he is a hell of a worker. Honestly, you have to show him once, and he doesn't need to be shown again. We've even asked him to stick around till 3 today to have a really deep clean of the drying room. He's taken over all the body prep, watched an autopsy, and not flinched at any of it. Best guy we've ever had down here. Even if he reminds me slightly of Marty Feldman in Young Frankenstein."
The guys laughed, but Karen didn't find it funny. Nick was coping, and these guys seemed to find him good to have around. Still, Karen thought she had better cover herself and inquire further.
"Can I ask, has he been a problem in any way? Has his work been up to scratch?"
"Yeah, I just said, his work's great, and he's willing to do anything. Just likes to be left alone when you aren't giving him an instruction. That's fine with us."
Karen smiled tightly, then headed back to the lift, bad taste pathologist humour following her up the corridor. Perhaps Nick was just taking their lead and getting it slightly wrong. At the end of the day, he was working with cadavers, and there was little harm he could do to them. She knew it was him she should be worrying about. He was functioning, even excelling in a job, and surely that was the most important thing. The little voice whispering in her ear that trouble was coming and something had gone wrong that might well be her fault had stopped by the time she got back to her computer. Her study would be groundbreaking, and sometimes hiccups along the way were just that. It would be Pete she would be interviewing to collate the data for the work-related part of the paper, and he didn't seem to have any misgivings. She headed back to her office and completed the morning log to read, "Observed Nick paying detailed attention to his work, leaning over body to make sure it was meticulously cleaned." Karen began to think that made much more sense, wrote up the lunchtime visit, did some research on different reactions to childhood trauma, and headed home at 6:30. She had tried to keep an eye on the car park through her window, but she had still been busy at 3 p.m, and she could see how he reacted on public transport in the morning. She was already excited about her journey in tomorrow. She would be up at the crack of dawn to make sure she didn't miss him. She walked in through the front door with her mind still full of her day, feeling she had made some progress. She stopped for a minute outside Tam's door, feeling she should say something, but she didn't know what would help, and she didn't want to take the lid off her feelings again. It was making her confused, and she needed all her concentration to get this paper finished. She would have plenty of time for a personal life when she had got her findings down. People were suffering right now due to a lack of clear, defined diagnosis, and she had no time to waste. On the way upstairs, she put her ear to Nick's door. She could hear him cleaning. She had never heard the Hoover on in the evening before, and it surprised her. Most autistic subjects hated loud noise. Perhaps being in a work environment was changing some of Nick's behaviours. Making a mental note to add this to the evening log, which she had been battling to see how she would fill, Karen almost skipped up the remaining stairs to her room. What the fuck was going on here? As she crossed the landing, she realised that noises were coming from inside her flat. The smell of cooking pervaded the landing, and laughter, children's laughter, and now male laughter, was coming from inside.
She froze again.
The overriding temptation was to creep back down the stairs and return to her office. It could only be the children and their father. What the hell was he doing in her flat? He probably wanted to give her another lecture. Racking her brains to remember what day she had said she would have the children, she was starting to retreat when the door was thrown open, and Jack stood there, grinning, his mouth covered in chocolate, and the guy behind him wasn't his father. It was Tam.
I lost a tooth!
He lost a tooth because Tam tied cotton round it and then the door handle and slammed it.
His big sister sounded disapproving and delighted all at the same time, while Jamie wandered over to the sink and started washing his hands methodically with a bar of soap. Karen realised she was still standing in the doorway, bag in hand, coat on.
Sorry, the kids were bored and charging around a bit, and the guy from the middle flat was banging on the walls, so I came up to calm the situation down, and they were hungry, so I made pancakes. Hope you don't mind.
Tam looked awkward now, shuffling from foot to foot.
Okay, I should get going now that your mum's here. I've probably ruined your dinner with the pancake feast.
The familiar looks of disappointment returned to her children's faces, and Karen dug deep inside herself for a reaction that would help.
No, stay. Let me get my coat off and we can see what to do after that. Sorry, you all took me by surprise.
Squeals of delight met this announcement from Jack, while Sarah bent forward to awkwardly hug her mother, and Jamie carried on washing his hands.
Dad is coming to pick us up at 9. We're going to France on a day trip tomorrow with him and his new girlfriend, so we have to be up really early. It's inset day at school, so we have the day off. I can cook supper if you like. I've learnt how to do spaghetti bolognese.
Sarah's young face was eager, looking for approval, already wearing the shadow of the serious, earnest woman Karen had grown into. A flicker of recognition that there must be more to life than work, resistant as she had become to the idea, ignited dimly in Karen's brain, and she hung her coat on the rack and smiled at her daughter.
Great! Spaghetti it is. I don't think we have the ingredients, so you might have to go to the shop.
No problem. I can go to the co-op. I need mince, Domio sauce, some garlic, and the spaghetti. £10 will be plenty, and I could get Coke and ice cream for the boys if you like.
Karen was about to embark on a lecture about balanced meals and the dangers of sugar, but she met Tam's eye and saw that he was waiting for her reaction.
Great. Yes, get ice cream and Coke, and the spaghetti ingredients.
Karen put down her bag and let her daughter squeeze her before she ran out of the door. The boys were around her legs, and she was led and pulled towards the sofa to watch cartoons. She looked at her watch. 6:20. And tried to do a mental approximation of how long she had before the children would be collected. She had seen people hyperventilate before, and she could now understand why. Jack climbed onto her lap, and Jamie sat on the end. Tam chose this moment to put a whiskey and water into her hand. Karen sipped, and tried to remember a situation where she had been this close to her children since they were babies. Jack was twirling one of her curls round and round his finger now, and making a noise like an aeroplane, while Jamie kicked the table in front of them rhythmically. The panic in her eyes must have been visible to Tam as he lifted his glass and mouthed cheers.
"Hey, boys, come over here. I bet I can beat you at arm wrestling."
Karen relaxed as Jack jumped down and ran to the table, and she sat at a safe distance keeping score for them in the battle which Tam was letting him win. She knew that mothers were important, empirically, and she knew that she had become distant and remote from her children. But images of Nick, alone downstairs, were already creeping into her mind. She sipped on her whiskey and smiled at Jack, who was now fully engaged with Tam. It didn't come naturally to her, smiling, and Karen wondered how she could be so good at analysing patients and compiling data, but no good at showing her feelings or developing her relationships with her own offspring. She often comforted herself by reading about successful historical characters in science or even the arts. Their personal lives were always difficult, Perhaps that was what it took to make breakthroughs. Sarah came back and asked for a big pan for the spaghetti. Karen didn't have one, and Tam was dispatched to find one. Boiling water, a splash of olive oil, and some salt. The spaghetti went in, everyone laughing at Sarah's bravery around the hob and steam, and ooing and aahing at the miracle of spaghetti softening from stiff to soft as it made contact with the water. Karen watched Jack go up on his tiptoes, trying to see what was happening, before Tam scooped him up and lifted him high enough to watch. Sarah showed them how to brown mince, then when it was cooked she poured in the sauce from the can. Karen watched her as she lapped up the claps from her brother and the high five from Tam. She drained the end of her whiskey and patted Sarah on the back. The rhythmic kicking of the coffee table carried on behind them, but was lost in the general hubbub. They were still scraping the bottom of the ice cream container when there was a ring on the bell. For the first time ever, the children seemed disappointed that their father had arrived. Tam buzzed him up, and Karen bit her lip to stop herself from saying something as her life was taken over. She preferred him to wait in the car, but he arrived at the door and looked genuinely pleased as the children all talked at once. Spaghetti sauce was wiped off mouths, and the three of them all hugged their mother and thanked Tam, who ruffled their hair and did up their coats.
"Come on, Jamie, up you get, we're going. Thanks, Karen."
Jamie got up and went back over to the sink. He had certainly taken the wash-your-hands rule to heart, Karen thought. Tam shut the door 2 minutes later, while the children shouted up the stairs, and Karen shouted back from above. She stood in the hallway as Tam came up behind her and put his arms round her gently. It was too much. She closed her eyes and let him kiss her neck. Sex had always been a release, a physical tension built up in her, but all it meant tonight was that there was going to be even less time left for writing. She had very little sexual tension left after the unexpected encounters with Tam this week, but she was grateful that he had been good to the children. With the hugs of her children still warm, the softer tone of her husband's still in her ears, and Tam's arms round her, she could still feel nothing. She allowed herself to be led to the bed, undressed, and when the time came, she kissed Tam back. As soon as she could feel he was ready, she pulled him between her legs and concentrated all her efforts on making him come as quickly as she could. It worked, and when he had finished, groaning from deep in his chest, he kissed her gently on the forehead, staring into her eyes and gently pushing a stray curl away from her mouth. Karen wondered whether he could tell that no one was home, and that the only face she could see was Nick's. Chapter 10 Tam. I love sleep. My life has the tendency to fall apart when I'm awake, you know? Ernest Hemingway. Wednesday morning. 6 a.m, for fuck's sake. Tam rolled over. He had woken up with a hard-on, and the scent of Karen was still fresh on her sheets. She must have got up to go to the bathroom. He called her name, and in the distance he heard the door slam. That moron from the middle flat. He had lain dead to the world for the last 9 hours, but was still feeling a bit rough around the edges from the whiskey the night before. He rubbed his eyes. She wasn't here. It was a tiny flat, and he was pretty sure he would have heard some sign of movement or ablutions by now. He crawled to the edge of the bed, pulled back the curtain, and looked out onto the path and the road. Nick was scurrying away from the house, darting from left to right like a gecko. He smiled to himself. Why Karen would take so much of her time obsessing over someone like that was beyond him. It had been a good evening, chilled, relaxed, and Karen's kids were pretty nice when you got to know them. He'd never wanted to be a dad, but it felt strangely good having a positive influence over children who had already been potty-trained and weaned by someone else, and who seemed polite and up for a bit of arm-wrestling. He had even imagined taking them out for a pint when they got older, but he was getting ahead of himself. It had just been a relief to have a normal evening and see Karen semi-relaxed. He had begun to think she did nothing but work and fuck like a hooker. Even the dad seemed to have calmed down a bit since their first encounter on the path outside. Tam would probably have been less than amused to be left with 3 kids to raise if he had been in his shoes. It wasn't natural. His train of thought was interrupted by the door slamming again, and he looked up to see Karen, fully dressed, hovering in the doorway, then scurrying down the path after Nick. What the fuck was she doing? Following him? She didn't get in her car, and Nick was clearly visible in front of her on the straight pavement, heading for the corner and the bus stop. That boy must wonder why he always had someone behind him who looked vaguely familiar. To be 2 minutes behind him, Karen must have been poised, waiting for him to leave. The image of her on the landing the day before popped into his mind. Women. What was the cliché? Can't live with them, can't live without them. Well, he would see her later, and at least they were finally getting somewhere after a failed start. Tam had been on his own a long time, and had never been great at commitment, so this was a good and unfamiliar feeling. He gathered up his things, which seemed to be scattered across Karen's flat, and went into the shower. He came out smelling flowery but clean, pulled on his clothes and went downstairs. He thought about tidying up, but decided that might look as if he assumed they were a couple, so he threw the ice cream container away and went downstairs. He plugged his phone in and looked at his messages, one from Danny at the Met yesterday and one from Karen this morning. Tam clicked on voicemail.
Morning, it's Karen, your neighbour. I've gone to work. I wanted to apologise for last night. I will talk to the children and make sure they don't bother you again. Thank you for looking after them, but it really wasn't necessary. I have a lot of work on, and they come to my house to do homework, so I would appreciate it if you could respect that. I'll see you sometime.
Her voice trailed off and was gone. Tam was annoyed at himself for feeling as if he had been kicked in the gut. That was it. His guard was going back up where that schizo was concerned, and it wasn't coming back down. Fucker. Seriously. No, actually, note to self, don't fuck her ever again, he muttered to himself. He made himself a coffee and sat staring at morning television. Holmes under the hammer was actually making him feel like moving. He didn't want to pass her on the stairs every day. Those poor kids, he thought to himself. She's a cold-hearted bitch, and they deserve better. The realization that he was upset enough by her curt voicemail to revert back into a life of takeaways and whiskey coincided with the news report. There they were again, the couple in the park. The guy had died the day before, and the girl had suffered life-changing injuries, which didn't sound pleasant. Tam took a deep breath, shook Karen out of his head and dialed Danny's number.
Hi, mate. Sorry I didn't call you back yesterday. Do you fancy a drink after work today?
Tam had decided that trying to do the right thing was seriously overrated. He arranged to meet Danny at 5:30 p.m., lay down, pulled the duvet over his head, and went back to sleep. When he opened his eyes, it was 4 in the afternoon, and he thought about shaving. Instead, he opened the freezer, took out the frozen cat, picked up the bag of clothing he had found in the bins, and put the lot into one of those bags that stop things melting when you shopped in Iceland. It was a chilly day, so he would be fine as long as the sun didn't get any stronger. He texted Danny that he would come past the office. He needed to ask a favour. They arranged to meet outside, which was a relief. Tam couldn't have taken a rerun of his last visit to the politically correct hotbed of police affairs. So it was that at 5:30 on the dot, a crumpled-looking Danny, in a zip-up fleece which expanded comfortably over his paunch, took possession of the forensic evidence, as Tam liked to think of it, from the bins outside the house.
"I'm just going to nip these upstairs, mate, and put the cat in the cold room. Normally if someone turned up here with a frozen pussy, I'd make a joke and tell them to fuck off. But as it's you, and you have the best nose for trouble I've ever come across, I'll make an exception." I don't need to tell you that we already have a big issue with the chain of evidence. This stuff has been in a bin, then in your flat, now here. What do you think it's going to prove?
I'll explain it all to you in the pub. Just get it safely tagged and logged and I'll give you the whole story. I have a hunch.
Say no more. Your spidey sense has always been good. I'll be back in 10 minutes.
Tam waited too, and then headed to the pub. He texted Danny the immortal words, "At the Albert, I'll get the drinks in." He felt almost like a copper again. Danny was 25 minutes. By the time he arrived, Tam was on his second pint. It had been intended for Danny, so he got another round in.
You're drinking fast. I can't keep up with you.
The blonde barmaid behind the bar seemed to be looking in his direction every time he glanced her way, and Tam smiled ruefully, picked up the two empty glasses, and headed towards her.
I haven't seen you in here before, she said. Your friend's a regular. Sweet guy. Think he needs a girlfriend, or a mum or someone to do his washing. You ready for another drink?
Long week, and I need to blow some cobwebs away. And by the way, my sweet friend has a wife and a kid. He just prefers the pub. As for me, give me another drink. It might help me relax.
She smiled at him, leant forward just a little too much, put her hand on his and said,
Let me know if you need any help with that.
Tam sat back down and began to explain to Danny about the weird guy who lived above him, and the neat letters in the hall, and the clock, and the bag of clothes in the bin, and finally, the cat. Danny was looking doubtful. Telling the story out loud, even Tam began to see that it sounded like the ramblings of a bored policeman with too much time on his hands.
It's not my area, of course, mate, but let's see if the blood is in the system, or even if it's human. Might be the best way to start. I don't know what I can do with the cat. Let's just keep it in the freezer for now. I think I'll just get one for the road.
Don't worry, mate. You're doing me a favour. Let me get the beers.
Tam knew blokes were supposed to be heartless bastards, but he was the one who had behaved well with Karen, and she'd been the bitch. If she didn't want him, then the best way to get over her was to get on top of someone else. Wasn't that what real men did?
2 pints of IPA, please, love. And a drink for you. Sorry, I don't know your name.
It's Molly. Thanks. I'll have a gym and slimline. Don't suppose you're at a loose end later. I get off in half an hour.
She managed to make almost everything she said sound sexually charged, and Tam felt himself getting turned on.
I'll walk you home, if you like.
Molly smiled and raised her eyebrows.
Yes, please. I hope I can trust you to behave.
She giggled. And Tam was torn between leaving the pub and trying to sort things out with Karen, and staying. He decided to stick to his guns. He was flogging a dead horse with Karen. She obviously wasn't interested. But he was also painfully aware that Molly's giggle was probably a clue to just how noisy she would be if they ended up in bed, and he felt exhausted just at the thought. His body clearly disagreed with him, and he pulled his jumper down before he picked up the pints and walked back to the table.
Looks like you're in there, mate. I envy you, footloose and fancy-free. Bloody hell, how old do you think she is? Can't be more than 22, you lucky sod. Look at those tits.
Tam had been looking. They were so pert and bouncy that it seemed impolite not to, and every time Molly pulled a pint they took on a life of their own, like blancmange when you carried it to the table. Not that he had seen that for years. Come to think of it, he hadn't seen 22-year-old breasts for years either. Tam sighed. He had tried grown-up life, however briefly. Now he would go back to cheap Pinot Grigio and fate's enthusiasm for the evening. He hoped she didn't live in a flat share. Shared bathrooms, now that would be depressing. But it was better than taking her back to his place to bump into Karen, judging and looking at him like a failure.
Your phone's ringing.
Tam picked it up, a little spark of hope igniting that he could just go home, put on the television, Karen would knock at the door, say sorry, or even act like nothing had happened, and they could cuddle up on the sofa. But it wasn't her number. He picked up.
Hello, Tam speaking.
Hello, my name is Martha. I am a cleaner, and I see your postcard in the shop window.
Oh, yeah, hi. I need someone for 4 hours twice weekly. Actually, I'm in a pub at the moment. Can I speak to you later?
Yes, I speak to you later.
Tam couldn't hear properly, and her accent was pronounced. He'd sort it out in the morning. He said cheers and hung up. He was achieving a few things now. The evidence was delivered, and it would be nice to come home to a clean flat twice a week. If he was going to get into freelance work or a new routine, he needed order to be maintained on the home front. For now, though, home seemed the least attractive option. If he was going with Molly, she'd better get a move on. He was on his fifth pint, and now he was less worried about any squealing Molly might be doing later, and more worried about not falling asleep. He needed to get the thought of Karen, and for some reason her kids, out of his head, and if he drank any more, he would be lucky if he got it up at all. An hour later, he was lying on his back with Molly on top of him, facing away so his eyes were on her back and her impressively curvy bottom. The experience was somewhere between painful and sexually exciting. She must go to the gym a lot. Her inner thigh muscles were really strong, and every time she plunged back down, he wanted to shout, "Gently!" This was probably the position that fractured guys' penises, and he concentrated on getting it over with. It was made worse by her continually asking questions.
"Do you like this? Shall I bend forward? Faster? Slower?"
Then there were the instructions.
"Put your hand here. Harder. Play with my breasts. Talk dirty to me."
He flipped her over, stopped worrying about what she was saying, kissed her hard to shut her up, and looked down at her firm young body. That did it, and he came in 2 minutes flat. Tension always made it more of a release, but even as he was coming, he felt sad for the loss of what he had done the night before, when he had been looking into Karen's eyes, and Molly's frenzied cries of,
"Yes, yes, yes,"
did nothing to cheer him up. He woke up twice during the night, with Molly enthusiastically giving him a blowjob. The first time he kept his eyes closed, grabbed her hair, and manipulated her like a blow-up doll, pushing into her mouth, which, to be fair, she seemed to enjoy, judging by the moaning. The second time, her liberal use of teeth during round one, which he hadn't really noticed at the time, had left him in pain and taken away all his enthusiasm, and he rolled away onto his tummy and dropped off, to the plaintive sounds of Molly saying in his ear,
"What about me, babe?"
He couldn't have cared less. Tam woke up disorientated and feeling as if he needed a shower. The room was not tidy. In fact, the bedside table was a testament to the youth of its owner. Tampax mingled with half-used makeup containers, a couple of tissues of unknown origin, and a bottle of lube. Lovely. He couldn't get out on his side, as he was leaning against a grubby wall, and he didn't want to wake her up. Apart from anything else, he couldn't remember her name, and his dick felt as if it had been in a mangle. Something was digging into his cheek, and he picked a false nail off his face. It was covered in glitter, and matched the ones on her hand. Gently, Tam slid the sheet off his body and started to shuffle towards the bottom of the bed and a clean getaway. Just as he was nearly there, she grabbed his head, which was now parallel with the top of her thighs. In the morning light, he realized that she didn't have a single hair on her body. That hadn't registered him a dark, drunken hour before he had fallen asleep. He had watched enough porn to know that pubic hair was a rare commodity these days, but Karen obviously hadn't got that memo, and he'd been glad. The next thing he knew, she was pushing his head towards her crotch and sleepily murmuring his name. Tam stretched out his legs, made contact with the floor, and jumped up. He had his limits, and she hadn't even showered since the night before. He looked around anxiously for any evidence of used condoms. Nothing. He was officially back to being a complete idiot. The journey home, in a tube filled with normal people apparently living normal lives, was a long one. Women talked to toddlers, read books on Kindles, ate wilted kale from Pret, and recoiled as he came through the carriage. He smelt bad, even he could tell that, and he knew from past experience that when you could smell yourself, that was not a good sign. He closed his eyes and vaguely remembered a bottle of tequila being produced from the barmaid's bag when they got home. The single life was not all it was cracked up to be. He seemed to be sweating pure alcohol, and the screams of "fucking bastard" and "you were shit in bed" still echoing in his ears weren't making him warm to the fully functioning smug marrieds or maybe just smug commuters surrounding him. He felt exhausted, and would spend the next 2 months praying she was on the pill and didn't have any STDs. His second youth was not working out any better than his few days of monogamy. When the front door of his house was finally in sight, Tam lifted his heavy eyelids and glanced up at Karen's window. He wasn't sure, but he thought he saw her jolt with surprise as she saw him. Did he imagine the look of disgust on her face before it disappeared behind the curtain? What the hell was she doing looking out for him at 8 a.m? Tam got the key in the door, leaning against the wall for support as he did so. Just as he was turning it in the lock, the door opened from the inside, and out came Nick, staring at the ground. He seemed even more agitated than usual, if that was possible, and as soon as he saw Tam, he jumped back into the hall and slammed the door in his face.
"Fuck this! Open the fucking door!"
Tam was furious, and had no sooner got his key back in the lock than Nick opened it again and rushed past him, talking to himself, head down and carrying a rubbish bag. He zigzagged towards the bin, smoothing his hair with one hand and lifting the lid of the bin with the other. Tam watched as he adjusted it a few times, and then carefully closed the bin and zigzagged back to the front door, slamming it behind him. Tam was exhausted and needed some sleep. But old habits died hard, so he walked to the bin, opened the lid, and stared at the white translucent bag. He could see the outline of a Shreddies packet and the triangle of a sandwich container. It looked like rubbish, general household waste. But he had started down this road now, and the binmen were coming tomorrow. He picked it up, just as Karen came scurrying out of the front door. She had already seen him from the window, that much was clear by the way she studiously looked straight ahead, but even she hesitated when confronted with him looking like an alley cat and removing rubbish. It only took a moment. Her mouth opened as if she was about to speak, then she closed it again and looked down. Walking purposefully to her car, she drove off without a backward glance. Tam had to resist the impulse to shout something after her like, "fuck you," or give her the finger behind her back. Instead, he went inside, carrying the spoils from the bin, and put them down, ready to be examined later. Then he had a shower, a long, hot one, trying to avoid his damaged dick, and went to bed and lay carefully on his side. His life was turning into a series of random nights in different beds, with crazy, fucked-up women. Chapter 11. Nick. We can easily forgive a child who is afraid of the dark. The real tragedy of life is when men are afraid of the light. Plato. Wednesday morning. Work had made fitting in all my week's commitments very difficult, and I knew I had to make more cuts. My teeth were grinding together, and I could feel how agitated I was getting, but I couldn't calm down. I had looked at my schedule the night before and decided that exercise was the only area where I could save time. I was going to order a skipping rope on Amazon and put "leave in the hall" on the delivery instructions. It could come tomorrow, which was Thursday, and I could start using it in my bedroom. It was probably not a good idea to go to the park at the moment anyway, even though I missed the deer. It made me feel upset. I had tried to go last weekend, but when I set out, I kept wanting to just go home, and I couldn't decide whether to keep going, and I got on the tube, then back the other way, and then eventually I got to the gates, and I saw posters of the man and woman who had been having sex by the pond. And I felt so agitated and worried that I just didn't go in. I went home on the bus. I still wanted to go to the police and tell them what the couple had been up to, and what I had done to stop them. But people weren't all like me, and they couldn't always see what was right. I had learned that a long time ago. My grandpa and my mother still had to visit every week. That was important. And if I tried to change it, they wouldn't understand. Work was important, and I was good at work. I would keep going to the morgue, whatever happened. I liked looking after the bodies. I felt relaxed around them, and I could do everything that I was asked to do by Pete. It was a calm place, and I sometimes wished I could sleep there instead of coming back to all the noises and interruptions of the house. Last night I unravelled both the sleeves on my jumper and bit my lips and chewed all the skin off round my nails, but I spat it out in case it had germs. Upstairs it sounded like an army was marching. The children, the neighbour from downstairs, the doors closing and opening, people running up and down the stairs. I tried putting on the Hoover, but it just made more noise, so I turned it off again. It went on for hours, while I sat with my back against the wall and banged my head against it. Eventually the front door closed and they got quiet. Then there was new banging, above my head this time, rhythmic against the same wall my head was on. Sex. I realized then, the neighbors were having sex again. They were doing it all over the house. I grabbed a cushion and screamed into it. This morning, for the first time in my life, I woke up and realized that I was on my side, on the floor, against the wall. I was cold. I hadn't had my shower, and I hadn't cleaned my flat or even emptied my bin. But my bed must be tidy, because I had made it yesterday before I went to work. My grandpa says, always make your bed. I needed to go to work today. I worked Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday now, because I was a good worker, and today was Wednesday. I tried not to worry about my list. I had told Grandpa I would be at work, and he was going to come at the weekend instead of Wednesday. Before I left, I had to change and brush my teeth. I had no idea how many germs I must have breathed in during the night. I had never slept anywhere outside my bed before, and my whole body ached. I needed calm, and I wanted to be in the morgue. I stood up, and straight away I couldn't keep still. My mouth was clenched. I thought about putting the clothes I had slept in into the dirty clothes basket for my mother, but the germs had probably had time to breed now, and she might not know how to kill them. So I peeled them off, all of them, and put them into the bin bag, then took them out again because I had thrown so many clothes away since that day in the park that I wouldn't have any left soon. I could take them myself to the laundrette for a boil wash when I wasn't working, and then I could send them to my mother afterwards for a normal wash. I spent an extra 10 minutes in the shower, with 4 soapings and 4 rinses. I needed to get out of the house and get to work, and I couldn't take a lift with Karen. It would be too much. I managed to comb my hair, holding the comb in both hands, taking it slowly. "Breathe," I could hear my grandpa saying in my head. "Breathe and take it slowly. It won't hurt if you don't panic." I wanted to cry. I picked up my knapsack, did up the clasps, and picked up the bin bag. I couldn't even tidy the flat or put the dishwasher on, and I didn't know what time it was. I just knew that I needed to leave. It took me twice as long as normal to get down the stairs. Every step was a challenge, and as soon as I got 1 foot down, the other one went back up, and then my downstairs neighbour got in my way just as I was going out. I was looking forward to the cool of the morgue, and as the cold air outside the front door hit me, I calmed slightly and laid my rubbish on the top of the bin. It felt like order and made me a little bit less panicky. My progress was slow down the path, and my head was jerking around, but I put 1 foot in front of the other on tiptoes, avoiding the cracks, and little by little, by keeping my eyes on the pavement, then the tube steps, then the pavement, I arrived at the hospital. As I went in through the entrance, the volume of people made me turn around for a moment, and then I noticed Karen, the neighbour who was responsible for me feeling like this, coming through the car park. I had managed to avoid her at least, and the thought of her trying to talk to me pushed me on through A&E, which was the name for accident and emergency, and to the lift and down, into the calm below. But things just kept getting worse. It was not calm. The floor from the lift was messy. That was the first thing I noticed. There was a nasty path made by the wheels of a trolley. It could have been mud or blood. I couldn't tell. But I didn't want my feet to get in it. I let the lift doors close, then open again, and on tiptoe I walked around and between it, avoiding contact like the cracks in the pavement. The mop was in the cupboard, and I hung my coat in the rest area. Luckily the wheels had gone straight on, and I filled the metal bucket with hot water and bleach. When Mark came round the corner, I was mopping 3 times over each section of the stain, making sure every trace was gone.
"Jesus, Nick, you scared the shit out of me. What are you doing? We need you down at the autopsy room. This can wait."
I looked ahead, and the trail led all the way down the corridor and was cut off by the double doors. Mark walked away, and I stood, rooted to the spot, panic rising. I hadn't really had to deal with anything like this yet, and I started mopping more quickly to get to the room without having to confront the sticky path ahead. I could see up ahead that it got worse towards the doors. I wouldn't be able to avoid it, as there were drops everywhere, and then a big pool of the same, as if they had stopped there. I started to sweat.
Nick, get your ass down here!
I hated that word, and I hated being shouted at. I suddenly had an idea, and kicked the bucket of hot water towards the worst of the mess. But it made things even messier, and the brown liquid started flowing back towards me. I ran to the restroom, head buzzing, and heard Mark shout again. Then I remembered. I had seen a sign upstairs which said, Chapel. When I was at school, I had gone to the school chapel to be calm, and I needed to be calm now. I jumped from the doorway of the restroom and got ahead of the water. Following the path I had already mopped, I tiptoed and zigzagged back to the lift, pressed the button, and the doors closed. I got out and followed the signs to let myself into the chapel, and sat on a wooden chair, which looked very clean. I started to cry. Every part of my body was moving and frantic, and I remembered another day when I had been in this hospital, and it was a long time ago, and the same panic was all the way through me. I curled my knees up and hugged them to my chest, and thought about the last time I had come here. I was 14, with a face full of spots, which I hated because they were full of germs. Mother told me I was going to see a doctor about my skin, so I had agreed, because I was having to change my pillowcase every time my face touched it because the germs from my spots were breeding there. She hadn't wanted to come, and so Grandpa had come to the house, and in the morning he talked to me about what to say and what I mustn't say, in case they locked me up. I didn't understand why anyone would lock you up for talking about spots, and I didn't understand what the games Grandpa played with me had to do with it either, although sometimes I did worry about germs, and it made me feel sick. Grandpa had germs on him, too. Everyone did. I had learned that in science. When we got to the hospital, we went to reception and inquiries, and Grandpa asked for psychiatry, and I said it should have been dermatology, because I always did my research, but no one listened. I was high on my tiptoes, knees bent, and we went along lots of corridors, but not the same one as goes to the morgue. And Grandpa told me again which things not to say, and we came to another reception, and someone told us to sit on chairs. After a long time, a man came out and called my name, and I pulled at Grandpa's arm, but the doctor told me to come on my own, and there would be a nurse chaperone. I didn't like it at all. I can remember it now. I had to spit in a cup, walk in a straight line, look into the doctor's face, and keep eye contact, tell them my mother's name, my father's name, stick out my tongue, and answer lots and lots of questions about how I was feeling. I was mostly feeling like I wanted to go home. Did I love my mother? Did I have friends? I wanted to tell them that one spot, the one on my chin, kept coming back, and I had looked it up and it needed antibiotic cream, but they didn't listen. The questions went on for hours. I stopped listening. My father didn't have a name, because he wasn't someone I knew. I didn't know what missing someone meant. What is the name of a young sheep? I knew that. A newborn sheep was a lamb. Then, at a year, they were called hoggets, so that one was right. I had to have a needle in my arm, and it was clenched so tight, and I was screaming so loud, that they couldn't get the needle in. My muscles were taut. I heard the nurse say so, and still no one came to get me. After a while of being still, they told me they needed to keep me there for observation, and not to get upset or they couldn't let me go home, so I tried to be calm, and I closed my eyes for the needle, and then they showed me a bed where I would sleep. But I told them I didn't have my pajamas and I had no slippers, but Grandpa had given them to the nurse. I hated him even more then. Tricking was bad, and lying, and he had done both. I didn't sleep, and I kept my slippers on in and out of the bed. I wouldn't get dressed into the dirty clothes I was wearing the day before, and I had to take a pill just to walk to the car still in my night things and go home calmly. I didn't speak, and I couldn't even look at Grandpa. When he said he would calm me down, I went to my room, and I jammed a chair under my door handle, and put my hands over my ears and screamed into my pillow. The white walls calmed me, and my bed was clean. I wouldn't eat for a long time. I had to wait and see if any of the germs in the hospital had got into me. I was very lucky they didn't. I wanted to be on my own, in my own place, with my own rules, and no one forcing me to do things. From then on, I knew to try as hard as I could not to get agitated. My nails were bitten down to below the quick, which is painful, and my teeth were clamped together. I walked on my tiptoes everywhere now, and I didn't go anywhere with Grandpa unless I had to. I knew he still had to correct me, and I knew he was trying to make me a man, but one part of me didn't believe him anymore when he said he was on my side and everything was for my own good. No one talked to me about the visit, but I saw Mother whispering to Grandpa, and then one day she left a letter on her desk when she was out shopping. I saw the name, Stephen Staniforth, and I remembered.
"Hello, Nick. I am Mr. Staniforth."
I remembered the questions, and the nurse, and the needle, and I picked up the letter and began to read. I am a very good reader. I have a visual mind.
"Dear Mrs. Peters, thank you for bringing your 14-year-old son Nicholas to see me recently for a psychological assessment and evaluation. I conducted a series of tests and a full physical examination, which was hindered to some extent by Nicholas's resistance to being touched and to removing or lifting up any of his clothes. It would be fair to say that I have no physical concerns, other than his being underweight for his age, and his inability to make eye contact or walk with his arms straight at his sides, or with his feet flat on the ground. It was difficult to assess the apathy about which you are concerned, as Nicholas was in a highly agitated state due to his anxiety at being in a strange environment with a group of people with whom he was unfamiliar. He seemed genuinely baffled by the series of questions regarding personal attachments and emotions, and was unable to answer most of them. He seemed unable to empathize. Even with hypothetical situations where it was suggested that harm befall you or his grandfather, he seemed solely concerned with practical considerations such as who would then do the shopping. He showed no emotion when I asked him about the death of his brother. I concur with your suspicions of autism, although I feel there is something else at play here. What would have started as Asperger's syndrome, borne out by Nick's high functioning at school in mathematics and science subjects, now seems to have been exacerbated by something, perhaps a psychotic break or early trauma, which could account for the sudden worsening of his condition. If there is anything that you are aware of that could have triggered such a reaction, it would be very helpful to know. Otherwise, I think for now, careful monitoring is in order. Nick needs a lot of support, consistent home life, and a gentle, unpressured routine, which should lessen his anxiety. I would suggest another assessment in a year's time, when we could also consider the use of Prozac or antipsychotic drugs, which I know you are resistant to, but I have had very good results with other patients who have similar symptoms to Nick. Let us hope that the situation improves, or at least settles over the next 12 months, and that we can then see where exactly on the autistic spectrum he fits. Kind regards, Stephen Staniforth.
I remember now, looking in the hall mirror, my head spinning, trying to see what the doctor had seen. I didn't like the letter, and I remembered thinking that the doctor and his chaperone nurse hadn't understood me at all. And here I was, back at the hospital, and it had started again. The panic I had felt that other time was even worse now, and I was a grown-up who should use coping strategies, but I couldn't make them work. I scratched at one arm with the other, wondering whether I should go back down to the morgue. I must be late by now. I looked at my watch, and it was 11:30. I had got to work early, and so they shouldn't have shouted at me. Now they had wasted my morning, and it wasn't my fault. I wanted to shout at the statue of Jesus in front of me, and ask him why he had made everyone so different and messy and demanding. I had good qualities. I was very clean, and very quiet, and very neat. It was lucky for me that I didn't need to earn money. My mother had enough for both of us. I was not demanding, and I didn't need anything from anyone else. The big problem for everyone else seems to be feelings. I know I laughed sometimes when people fell down or when they cried. Mother was upset when I did that. Everyone has a good side and a bad side, Grandpa always says. I think he is right, but I am not laughing because I am bad. I am just laughing. At 10 to 12, I went to the lift, and when the doors opened, the floor was clean and dry. I went to the freezer room and put on my apron. This was better. I went to find Mark and Pete to ask them what they wanted me to do. My heart had slowed down, and I felt ready for the day ahead. When I came into the rest area, Karen was sitting there with Mark and Pete. I didn't like her being down here.
"Nick, are you all right?"
I decided to ignore her and talk to Pete instead. He is the person in charge of me. I asked him what I should do. He didn't reply. She did.
"Nick, do you remember I told you that you would be on a trial for the first couple of weeks down here?"
My heart sped up, and I found a loose piece of thread on the arm of my jumper. I pulled it.
"Nick, this morning when you arrived early, there was a family waiting in the room to see their daughter's body. Do you remember you helped get her ready yesterday? When you came in, you were upset. Do you remember screaming and kicking the bucket of water down the corridor? You were shouting, Nick, and everyone could hear you, and they got quite scared and upset."
"No one should have shouted at me. I didn't shout first. I was cleaning up the blood on the floor, germs. I was early, and now I'm late because they shouted." I tried to remember earlier. I couldn't remember screaming. I couldn't remember anything now. All I knew was that I didn't want to be here. I needed to go home. I pulled my gloves off and dropped them on the floor and wanted to go and say goodbye to the bodies, but I knew that no one would understand that. I realized I was crying again, and my nose was running, and usually, except this week, I didn't cry. I hadn't cried for a long time. I was wailing, and no one was here to make me be quiet. Not my mother, not Grandpa. I had seen the sign for stairs next to the lift, and I ran from side to side, but towards it, on my tiptoes, arms waving. Before I could get there, Pete and Mark caught me from behind, and I screamed. "Come on, Nick, it's fine. Let's just have a cup of tea and talk about it." I screamed again. I remember that. "Nick, if you can't calm down, we're going to have to call upstairs and see if a doctor can come and help. Take some deep breaths." I didn't want a doctor, and I knew what would happen if one came. I tried to listen to my own sounds and make them still. I needed to go home. I took the tea. 3 tries to get it into my mouth, and then I took a gulp which burnt me. I nearly threw the cup across the room, but I grabbed my hand with my other hand. Steady. After 10 minutes, they were still talking, and I began to remember the rules. Make eye contact. That wasn't working. Nod. I could manage that. Breathe. I sipped, and I nodded, and I breathed, and I blew my nose. My heart was banging in my chest, but they couldn't see that. When Karen offered to order me a taxi, I nodded. When she took me upstairs, and after Mark and Pete had said their goodbyes and said sorry, and what a good worker I had been, and I bit hard on my cheek to stop myself from crying again and tasted blood, but I didn't shout at them, I got into the taxi and went home. Pete told me to take a couple of days at home and calm down, but I was so tired, I never wanted to go out again. I was looking forward to just being on the path leading to my own front door. It was nice not to have to smell people and be squashed on the tube or in a car that smelt of curry like the one I was in now. I got out of the car and took out my wallet with my allowance in it, but I didn't even have to pay, and I went towards the front door past the bins on my right. It was familiar. So much had happened, and now I was just going to sleep. I had wondered if the police would come to see if it was me who had taught the couple in the park a lesson, but they hadn't. If they were going to come, it would have been by now. I went inside and tried to breathe. It wasn't calming me down. I needed a paper bag like Grandpa brought me sometimes when I got very upset. I straightened the letters on the table, I took down my note about a job. I couldn't get the letters straight, and the note was making me want to cry again. I went up the stairs, pulling myself upwards with one hand while my feet refused to behave, and my other arm waved around, and my face was scrunched up so tight I could hardly get my key in the lock, even though usually it was easy.